This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. This is your host, Tim Link, and I'm so glad you're joining us today. I'm super excited about the show today. The author and writer is fantastic, and he's doing a deep dive into the whole dog world. Of course, we're talking about author Tommy Tomlinson and his latest book, Dogland, The Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. So we'll talk to Tommy a little bit about the book, talk about writing in general, and then we'll delve into, obviously, the whole world of dogs, as we love to do on this show. So everybody hang tight. We'll come back right after this commercial break. You're listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Joining me for this episode is the author of The Elephant in the Room. He's also a Pulitzer Prize nominee for his writing and commentary. And he was a 2005 finalist for that. Obviously a longtime writer for the Charlotte Observer. He's written for Sports Illustrated, Forbes, Esquire. He knows it all about writing. And this particular time, he's coming to us about the whole world of dogs and dog shows. The book's called Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. Of course, we're talking about our friend Tommy Tomlinson. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tim. I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, we're excited. And I was super excited to hear about the book because, you know, being a dog lover, you've got to keep track of the Westminster Dog Show. I have a lot of clients that participate in the whole dog show world as well as participate in the Westminster Dog Show. But to get in behind the scenes and really find out what it's all about is, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, hopefully none of the bad or the ugly, mostly good and slobbers. But I love the topic. So tell us a little bit about, you know, Dogland, what it's about, how it came to be, and then we'll sort of take it from there.
It came to be kind of simply. I was at home one night watching one of the dog shows, which I, you know, had done for years and years. And I just had this thought, are those dogs happy? Because they live such a different life than your normal household pet, you know, as you probably know, a show dog is picked sometimes at the time they're just a few weeks old and moved into that show world where they eat differently, they're trained differently, they travel differently, and it culminates in these shows that they go to pretty much every weekend from the time they're very young. And so I just wondered whether that life was a life that those dogs tended to enjoy. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, how about regular dogs, just household pets? Do they enjoy their lives too? Because they don't really have a choice in who they end up with or what they have for breakfast every day and all those sorts of things. They certainly seem happy, but are they really? And what does science know about this stuff? And what are sort of the theories? And so it's sort of a two-part book. Part of it is looking, kind of taking an in-depth look at Westminster, especially at kind of the dog show world, but using that as kind of a gateway to think about dogs and their people and that long, long relationship in sort of a bigger, more universal way.
Yeah. And when you took on the topic, one of the things that hit me right off the top was, okay, how do you get into this exclusive world? Is it a matter of putting on a press badge and you just show up and put a microphone in somebody's face? Or do you have some nuances to actually get in there? Because this is, I mean, especially when we're talking about the Westminster Dog Show, this is serious business when it comes down to it.
It is. And Westminster was the first show I ever went to, which is like your first football game being the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And so I knew very little about what I was doing when I first walked in there. And some people were not particularly responsive. I mean, the dogs are world, like any subculture, can be kind of wary of outsiders. There had been that movie Best in Show, which a lot of people in the dog show world didn't appreciate. And so I think every time somebody from the outside comes walking in, there's a little bit of a flinch, you know, in that world. Like, what is this person going to say about us? And so it took a while to sort of work my way in. And it took talking to quite a few people before I found some people who were comfortable talking about me and could see the dog show world from the inside and the outside. They love dogs, love dog shows, but they could also step back and detach from it a little bit and see sort of the humor in it, the absurdity in it sometimes, and the things that other people wonder about when they go to dog shows. They were able to kind of talk about those things in layman's terms.
Yeah, it was always fascinating to me because though it seems very serious and very staunch, and I want to talk to you about, you know, what you really found out about the dogs behind the scenes, but I would imagine from an outsider looking into this, it would be almost like, you know, prepping a horse for the Kentucky Derby. You know, what's the horse's like, prepping him and getting him or her, you know, ready for the race, and then what happens afterwards. Or even like if you have a pageant participant or a young actor or actress, you know, wanting to come up and you're raising them, they're your child at home, but on the other hand, they got to put on a show when they go on the stage. How did you find it as far as, I know the dogs have separate handlers in most cases, but how did you find that separation of when the, first of all, the human companions knew to put on a show with their dogs, and then what happens afterwards? And then how did the dogs respond? Was there any difference on how they acted during the show and after the show?
Well, I think the dogs do understand that when they're in the show ring, it's a performance. And, you know, like a dog would do a trick. It's kind of a trick in a way, you know, to do this stack, which is the pose they have to do for the judges, and to trot around the ring. You know, they're doing something that they're handlers have trained them to do and now are asking them to do. And it's sort of a performance, like, you know, fetching a tennis ball or something like that. And so I think when they're inside the ring and outside the ring, they can be very different. Although a lot of the dogs I saw were extremely disciplined and attentive to their handlers, both inside and outside the ring. Others, I thought, saw a little bit of separation and were a little more goofy, you know, when they weren't in the ring showing off, basically. The handlers, I think, by and large, try to treat those dogs as normal dogs as often as they can. You know, they take them out for walks. They run them around. They play with them. They sort of roll on the floor with them when they're in between events and all that sort of thing. But when it's showtime, obviously the dog not only has to be trained to perform, but it has to be groomed really carefully, you know, look as good as possible. The nutrition has to be really on point so that the dog, you know, looks its very best. And so there are moments when they're clearly being a show dog. And I think for most of them, moments when they're clearly also being a regular dog. And sometimes it was easy to split the difference, and sometimes maybe not so much.
Yeah, and I'm curious about the dogs and how they handle it, let's say after the show, as you just mentioned, but as I mentioned, you know, they often have a separate handler compared to their, what I call the human companion. I always had this vision that all three of them were standing in a room. The dog was like, you know, moving its head back and forth, trying to decide, okay, who do I actually listen to in this case?
Right. So most dogs, especially the level of something like a Westminster, the person who handles the dog, the person you see in the ring with the dog at the show, does not own the dog. So the dogs have owners that basically put these dogs in the hands of a handler to take it around the country and take it to shows. There are owner handlers who do both jobs, and sometimes they make it as far as the finals of Westminster. But by and large, the very top show dogs usually have a separate handler. And I talked to some of the owners and handlers about all this, about that relationship. And the owner said a couple of things I thought were interesting. One was that it's sort of like you have a kid who may be, let's say, gifted in tennis. And in your town, wherever you live, you know, they've beaten all the other 8-year-olds at tennis. So maybe you send that kid off to a tennis academy to see if they really are that good and might be a professional one day. Well, that means they're not with you anymore, and that you might be They might be gone for years, but you're investing in something that's possibly greater. So that's one explanation. The other one I thought was pretty interesting was that to the owner, a beautiful show dog is like a piece of art. And the best way to show that piece of art is to put it in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing, can show it at its best angles, can make it look as beautiful as possible. So when it's in the ring, when it's in front of all these other people who know who that dog belongs to, that its artsiness, its beauty, its inherent beauty is enhanced as much as it can be. And I think those are both pretty interesting ways to think about it.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful analogy. I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way. And one thing you had hit on that you had, one of the words that caught my attention when you were speaking about the first part of that is the investment part of it. Now, I don't want to get into too much of the nitty gritty behind that, but we have to realize there's a huge investment to go to these shows and to show these shows and handler charges and grooming, et cetera, et cetera. And then what about the back in return of the investment? I'm assuming it's more than just trophies and ribbons that you and your dog can sit around and reminisce. I'm sure there's breeding, and the higher up in the rankings your dog goes, the more your investment gets returned. Would that be a fair analogy or a fair statement?
There's some of that, but it's not nearly as lucrative as, say, horse racing. So like you mentioned the Kentucky Derby a while ago, the Kentucky Derby winner, that owner will make millions of dollars in stud fees and breeding and all that sort of thing for years. The owner of a champion show dog, first of all, to win the show itself, when you win Westminster, there's no prize money. You get a couple of trophies and a ribbon and that's it. And in fact, at smaller dog shows, the prize is usually a ribbon and a sack of dog food. So you're not going to get rich just by winning dog shows. And you're actually also not going to get rich breeding out your dogs or stud fees or breeding fees. There is money in that. I'm not going to completely diminish it. But I think most owners of top show dogs, they spend six figures a year sending those dogs around the country to all the big shows. The payback for that is not nearly as much. Most of those folks go in the red and they consider it, you know, like sending your kid to college. You're going to spend some money and what you're going to get back is intangible. Maybe it's something lucrative. Maybe it's not, but probably not. And so I think people overestimate how much money these folks make. The handlers make money. The people who put on the shows make money, but the owners generally do not.
And just like sending your kid off to college, they often return back home with you at the end of the day. So, well, I think it's a great clarification. That's why I sort of led you down that path, because I knew it was much different than it is in, say, horse racing, as we've been talking about that analogy. But it really is more of what I've seen is it's a passion. It's a love. You've got an animal that you're a dog that you're extremely proud of. You think there's a chance to let other people enjoy what your dog can do and how it looks. And that is reward enough in most cases.
I think it is. And I think that's the way most owners look at it. There is obviously people have a competitive nature. They want their dog to win. There's some pride in that. And people push pretty hard to have winning show dogs. But I think in the end, it is about more than the rewards, the trophies, the ribbons, the money, even the payback for that, the return on investment is much more in intangible things.
Very good. Now, when we talk about most, if not all, of the human companions and even their handlers have a particular breed that they're ultimately fond of, and we've seen these big shows, it's almost, maybe it's not as extreme as when we see the 101 Dalmatians. Now everybody has to have a Dalmatian, but we do see that with shows like Westminster that, you know, if a particular breed wins, all of a sudden everybody wants that particular breed. Did you find that is sort of a badge of honor, sort of excitement, because I'm a Schnauzer guy, for instance, I love Schnauzer. So if a Schnauzer wins, I'm going to be proud, even though it may not be my Schnauzer there, or let's just say it won't be my Schnauzer there. but do you see a pride in that, knowing that everybody's going to go out and get a Schnauzer now? Or is it more of the fact that it's an isolated type thing where they're proud of their dog? And if people happen to be excited about that particular breed, then that's great.
I think it is an isolated thing, and I think it's actually kind of funny. I think what show dog people consider to be a great dog is very different than what regular people think to be a great dog. A good example is the first Westminster I went to back in 2020. In the final round, you know, there's seven dogs make it to the best in show round. And one of the dogs was a golden retriever named Daniel. This absolutely perfect specimen of a golden retriever. And that's when the show was at Madison Square Garden, the last time they had it there, although it's actually getting ready to go back there next year. Anyway, the crowd at Madison Square Garden cheered and stomped their feet and loved this golden retriever. There was another dog in that final seven, a poodle, who looked just like, you know, your quintessential poodle with the funky haircut and all that sort of thing. And the fans were not nearly as much into the poodle. Well, the poodle won best in show. And the crowd actually booed a little bit when the poodle won. And so they weren't going out to get a poodle the next day. But the funny thing was, I was on the floor of Madison Square Garden with all the dog people, and all the dog people instantly said, the right dog won. And so I think that the aesthetics that dog people consider to be pleasing and important and valid, and the sort of the characteristics they think of as a champion, are often very different than what you and I might think of. That doesn't mean, I think you're right, that occasionally when a particular dog wins, people do go out and buy that dog. But I think more than that, now people buy dogs or acquire dogs for more lifestyle type reasons. Like, for example, the French Bulldog dethroned the Lab the last 2 years as the most popular dog in America. And I think the main reason for that is that it's portable. You know, people could take it from an apartment to a house, to a condo. You can move a lot. The Frenchie doesn't need to be, have a lot of yard space, doesn't need to be walked a lot. And that sort of thing. As a dog, you can just, if you're young and mobile, you can pick up and take it with you pretty easily. That's one reason I think that the Frenchies are so popular. And so I think there are a lot of lifestyle reasons why a particular dog sort of surges up the ranking.
Very interesting. Good point. Good point. Early on, you talked about, okay, well, are these dogs happy? And you established that for the most part, they're happy. And they know they got sort of a job to do. They like their show, but they also have fun at home. What about just your everyday dog, your golden retriever you have at home, or your schnauzer who barks at every delivery guy that comes to the door? Did you find that they're happy? And is it a different type of happiness? Or is it all the same at the end of the day?
One of the things that I think a lot of research is starting to figure out, and intuition tells you this too, is that more than any other creature on earth, besides people, and maybe even including people, dogs have figured out a way to adapt to make their own happiness, so to speak. Dogs have been by our side for somewhere around 30,000 years. And in that time, their jobs have changed just immensely. You know, they started out as basically power tools. You know, they pulled sleds and they caught game and they did all these things that, like blue collar labor jobs that we early human beings needed them to do. Well, over all this time, they've evolved to the point where most dogs are basically therapy dogs now. There are companions, there are housemates, there are friends and sounding boards. That is a huge change in personality that a dog has had to make, a change in a role in the human family, but dogs have managed to figure out ways to make themselves happy. And I think part of that adaptation is they have always been in tune with what makes us happy. You know, there's at least some research that says that when a dog and a person lock eyes, when they look at each other, they both get a dose of oxytocin, which is this pleasure enzyme. And so kind of no matter what you ask a dog to do, or what situation you put a dog in, as long as it's not abusive, the dog finds a way to kind of deal with it and be happy. And that happiness, their ability to adapt to our needs and our desires, is a big thing that makes us happy. And so that sort of mutual admiration society, as I think, is part of the reason that had this partnership for thousands and thousands of years.
Very good. I like that. And of course, it's just another reason to live a dog's life. Always be happy, adapt to your situations, and find the pleasure in life. I think that's the key.
It's a pretty good way to live.
I think so. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, continue our conversation after the break with Tommy Tomlinson and his book, Dogland. I also want to talk to Tommy a little bit about writing in general. So everybody, hang tight. We'll come back right for this break. You're listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio.
Hi, this is Tim Link, animal communicator and pet expert, and host of Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have you ever wanted to know what your pet is really thinking? Do you want to find out if they truly understand what you're trying to tell them? Or wish you could build a better understanding and closer relationship with your pet? Well, now you can. Learning to communicate with animals is a four-part on-demand workshop. In the workshop, you'll learn the essential techniques that are necessary to communicate with animals, including what is animal communication, breathing correctly to achieve the perfect state to communicate with your animals at a deeper level, using guided meditation exercises as a method to communicate with animals, and how to send and receive information from your animals. So if you're wanting to learn how to communicate and connect with your animals at a deeper level, visit petliferadio.com/workshop and purchase and download Learning to Communicate with Animals. You'll be glad you did.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Continue our conversation with Pulitzer Prize finalist Tommy Tomlinson in his book, Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. Now, Tommy, when tromping around the country, talking to all the people, seeing all the dogs, taking all your notes, putting it on a whiteboard or whatever your style is, how did you find writing the book as far as did you have more material than you could possibly deal with and you're coming out with part two of the dog show? Or was it a matter of structuring through your notes to get the perfect book?
Well, if you do it right, you always have more material than you know what to do with.
Exactly.
And there's always a winnowing down process, at least for me, where I try to figure out what to leave in and what to leave out. And that can be, you know, grueling, but it can also be a lot of fun. And for me, the key is to try to figure out what the book is really about. I mean, I think of every kind of piece of writing or every storytelling has two levels. One is sort of the text, which is what you might call the plot. So this book, the plot is, you know, you follow a champion dog and its handler through the Westminster Dog Show, and you learn about the relationship between dogs and people. That's sort of the punchline, the elevator pitch for this book. But what it's really about, and what it took me a while to sort of land on, is it's about connection. You know, how human beings and dogs have this great desire to connect to another living creature, and how dogs, more than any other creature we know, have figured out a way to connect to humans. And so that's part of the reason we love and admire them so much. And so as I was going through my notes, as I was going through the scenes I'd witnessed, interviews I'd done, I thought, what does this particular moment have to do with connection? And generally, if it didn't have much to do with it, that's the kind of stuff I would tend to leave out. Now I would have an occasional aside, not every page of the book is about that thing, but I wanted the drift of the book, the main focus of it, to be about connecting, because I think that's a universal thing that everybody wants, everybody cares about. And so as I went through my stuff, that's how I kind of narrowed the focus, was figuring out how to talk about that part of it.
And I love how you did that. So big kudos on the book and as a whole. But, you know, when you first get a book, I don't know about you, when you first see a book written by someone, obviously, you know, beautiful cover, got the dog on there, always have a dog on your cover. It helps sell books. But, you know, I sort of get this first impression. It's like Dogland, you know, a Westminster Dog Show. Okay, I'm going to find the scuttlebutt about Westminster Dog Show. That's what I was fully intending to get when I opened up the book. And then as you eloquently put it all together, this is really a book more about, you're going to learn about, dogs and dog shows in Westminster, and you're going to learn about animals and dogs in our lives at home, but it's that connection. And that was the real sort of icing on the top of it for me when I read through the book, is the fact that, it's a whole lot more than that. We've got enough scuttlebutt in life. Let's talk about how we can really connect, and our animals, particular dogs, do that probably better than anybody.
Yeah, I like stories, and I like writing stories where it starts out kind of being about one thing, and then it evolves, and you kind of get maybe an emotional punch that you weren't expecting. You know, it hits harder than you thought, or it, starts out kind of funny and light and ends up, you kind of, it's like a great Disney movie or something like that, where by the end, you just feel really emotionally invested in these people and what they're talking about and thinking about. It turns out to be maybe more of an emotional experience than you expect. And so I hope that's kind of what people took from this book as they went through it, is that it starts out being about Westminster and about dogs and the show dog world, which can be sort of funny and absurd. But slowly, as you turn the pages, maybe it kind of evolves into something a little deeper and I hope a little more profound and interesting.
Absolutely. Well, the book does that. Dogland, Passion, Glory, and lots of slobber at the Westminster Dog Show for sure. I do have to ask you about writing in general before I let you off the hook here, because you're obviously multifaceted. You know, you're a successful author of books. You've written columns. So being a columnist is a much different story than that. And then you've written, very excellent pieces for various different types of magazines and topics. Is there one you prefer better than the other, or is one more challenging than the other, or can you sort of parlay what you do with, say, writing a piece for a particular magazine to what you're doing as a columnist and as an author?
It helps to think about it as sort of playing with Legos or building blocks or something. A column that I would write when I was in my newspaper days might be 600 words. A magazine story that I might write for ESPN or Esquire or something might be 6,000 words. And then this book is probably 70,000 words. But if you think about a book as, oh my God, I have to sit down and write 70,000 words, your brain freezes.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to break it down into smaller pieces. And so I would break it down into like, okay, today I'm just working on this little section. And when I get this little section done, that will lead me to the next little section. And when I've written a few of these little sections, hey, what do you know? I've got a chapter. And when you've written some of these chapters, hey, what do you know? I've got a book. And so it just helps to like not think too hard about it being a really big major project. Just make it like a little project for you every day. And this is what people teach about everything, right? From exercise to any big task in your life that you want to complete. If you try to like swallow it whole, you'll never get there. But if you break it down into small pieces that are more manageable, that's how it gets done.
Nice. I like that. I like that. So good words of wisdom there, because you're absolutely right. Especially, you get excited about a book and perhaps you turn in the first few chapters and get the editors all excited about it. And then they say, okay, great. Go write it and give it to us in 3 months. And all of a sudden you got to come up with, 60,000 words.
Right. And that's what I tell people about writing a book, is the main thing about it is it needs to be something you're willing to live with for a while. Because it took, COVID was a part of this, but it took me almost 4 years from the time I started working on this book till the time it came out. And so, if you're living with a project that you don't enjoy or that feels like, drudgery every day, you're really going to hate it by the time you're done. So make sure whatever you choose something you're excited about and that you feel happy about walking in there every day. That doesn't mean that you're going to be thrilled with the work every single day. Professionals write even when they don't even feel like it. But it does mean that by and large, you need to be excited about what you're doing.
Nice. I like it. I think that's good words of advice for all of you writers and people wanting to publish their books, but also good lessons for life in general. Be passionate about what you're doing, enjoy what you're doing, and at the end of the day, you can feel proud about all the things you've accomplished. Well, Tommy, thanks for coming on the show. It's fantastic. Everybody pick up a copy of the book. It's called Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show by Tommy Tomlinson. Tommy, congratulations on a fantastic book, and we'll look forward to chatting with you somewhere down the road.
Thank you so much. This was a blast. I appreciate you having me.
My pleasure. Well, we're coming to the end of the show today. I want to thank everyone for listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. I want to thank the producers and sponsors for making this show possible. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for the show, you can get a hold of us at PetLifeRadio.com, and we'll be glad to answer your questions, entertain your comments, bring on the people you want to hear from most. And while you're there, check out all the other wonderful hosts and shows. It's a cornucopia of barking fun. So until next time, write a great story about the animals in your life, and who knows, you may be the next guest on Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have a great day.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.